Hi, I'm Francis Lamb. Thank you for downloading this week's podcast. If you ever want more on anything you hear today, you can always find it at splendidtable.org. You'll find recipes, videos, giveaways, and lots of info on all our guests and their work. That's splendidtable.org. And here's this week's show. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. The show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. So this week, we have a great show of autumn eating. Mushrooms, Dory Greenspan talks to us about butter, and we even get into the ever-controversial pumpkin spice. But first, I want to talk about two of the most exciting things I've tasted this year. One was a cedar tea, literally cedar branches steeped in water, and the other was just a nut, a pignon nut that was creamy and buttery, and even right out of the shell, it tasted like it had already been candied. Chef Sean Sherman brought them for me here in the studio, and they were so exciting because they tasted totally new. But these foods are not new. They're just part of a tradition of Native American food that's been hidden from sight, nearly hunted to extinction by forced migration and industrial food and shame. Now, Sean calls himself the Sioux Chef. That's S-I-O-U-X. And he's on a mission to bring Native foods to the fore and to instill pride in Native cooks. Sean's written a book, The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, and we sat down to talk about what's gone into his journey. So, hey, Chef, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I would love to start from the beginning with you.
Okay.
You grew up on a reservation in South Dakota.
Yeah, Pine Ridge Reservation.
Yeah, so tell me about growing up there and what you were eating.
Well, Pine Ridge Reservation itself sits in South Central South Dakota. It's really wide open and vast. It's almost deserty because it's right on the edge of the Badlands. So there's a lot of cactus and there's a lot of desert plants around. There was a lot of coyotes. There was a lot of rattlesnakes and bull snakes, things like that. And, you know, we didn't really have a lot of the traditional foods growing up. We definitely had a lot of commodity foods. We definitely did hunt. So we did have some antelope and some venison and some goose and some duck on occasion, lots of pheasant and grouse. And we did pick things like chokecherries and timsala, which is the wild prairie turnip, juniper berries. But, you know, looking backwards as a chef much later in life, I realized there should have been a lot more knowledge of the traditional foods of the Lakota. And that's kind of what kind of set me off on the path, was really trying to figure out just the food of my own heritage.
Yeah. So you came from the reservation and you eventually got a job quite young, cooking in restaurants, and you cooked for over 20 years. You were well into your career as a chef before you decided to focus on researching indigenous foods and in some cases the foods of your heritage, but the foods of indigenous people around the country, North America in general. What inspired this sort of mid-career change in your focus then?
Well, I'd say I was a few years into my official chef career in Minneapolis, and I was learning lots of different styles, you know, from all over the world. And it just kind of hit me once. You know, it was when I was living down in Mexico that it really became apparent, and it felt like an epiphany kind of moment where I saw the path of trying to understand the indigenous foods of, first off, just Lakota, of where I grew up. And really trying to dig backwards and, you know, realizing that I needed that knowledge of wild plants. I needed the knowledge of agriculture and food preservation. And, you know, it just kind of set me on that path of trying to figure all those different pieces out. To this point today, where we are looking at North America as a whole through all the different indigenous communities from the tip of Mexico all the way up through Alaska, you know, the whole picture of it. So it's pretty exciting to think about. But looking backwards, when I first kind of had that epiphany, I realized that there wasn't a lot of information out there and there was no representation, hardly. Mm. There was a few restaurants that really tried and did well, like Loretta Barrett Odin's restaurant, and a few other people like Lois Ellen Frank.
Where are they?
They're in the Southwest.
Okay.
And I just, you know, really wanted to, you know, further it and really try to make food that was as authentic as possible and just digging through all of it with a culinary sense of trying to put it all back together.
Yeah. It must be so hard to learn about the past when, in a lot of ways, as you said, as you grew up in your family, there wasn't a whole body of knowledge, of traditional knowledge that you knew of, that somewhere along the line, those traditions had been dissipated or maybe were sort of cut off. And in a situation where you are looking at native foods in a place where native people often were removed from the land where they, you know, where they developed their traditions and where a lot of their history wasn't written down, how do you find the truth of the past?
Part of it was just really researching the food. So I felt like the plants really had a lot of the story to tell. So really getting to know nature and the plants and how the indigenous communities were utilizing the wild plants around them, not only for food, but for medicine and for crafting and just daily life in general. But, you know, for me, I'm not trying to dig all the way back to 1491 to pre-Columbian. You know, I was really just digging to, you know, how were Lakota eating before they were influenced by another culture? So that doesn't go that far backwards when you think about it, because for my family line, my grandparents were the first generation of kids to go through boarding schools on Pine Ridge Reservation. And my great-grandparents' era were, they were still growing up on the plains with the Lakota as they always had and still maintained a lot of their indigenous food systems at that point. So it's only looking back a few generations, really. But because of the oppression and because of the way things went, relocating and moving, you know, Lakota around and, you know, placing them in a place where they weren't used to staying, you know, all year round, it was tough to try to piece it back together. So talking to lots of elders and also just looking at other parts of the country, how other people are doing things, because there's varying degrees of different tribes that have more or less of their food systems intact and, you know, realizing there's a lot of commonalities with it out there too.
Yeah. And so what is the food you're cooking today? What are some of the ingredients in the dishes that are important?
So we really just like to focus on region. As we travel around, we've been able to travel across the U.S. and Canada. And we really just like to think about where we are when we're there. And we think about the season. We think about the history of the people that were living there before. And we try to bring out that authenticity of those areas because there's so much diversity. You know, when you look at the indigenous map of North America, you just see so much diversity. It changes, you know, religion and culture and beliefs and food every, you know, few hundred miles. And it's exciting to explore in a culinary sense because there's just so much food out there that we haven't been utilizing.
Yeah. But as a chef, there are lots of things that would be common in restaurant kitchens that you don't use, right?
Yeah. Well, we've tried to cut out anything that wasn't here before. So we've cut out, you know, main things like dairy, wheat flour, processed sugar, beef, pork, chicken. And really look at the wild foods that are around and the flavors that are there. If there was indigenous agriculture in those regions, what kind of varietals are there and if they're still around. And looking at all the fish and the birds and the animals and, you know, the techniques that people would have utilized to produce these foods and creating something new with them. So we're not trying to do a timepiece. We're actually just rebuilding the pantries and then doing some new things with it. And, you know, the food becomes extremely beautiful and simple and healthy and just the simple presentations that they are.
Yeah, and you brought a few things with you. So this is a cedar maple tea.
Yep, and that was our main beverage for the Tatanka truck food truck when we opened it up. Since we weren't selling any sodas or Gatorades or anything like that, we were, you know, just using simple tea. So just cedar bough and maple, and we have that recipe in the cookbook. And it's just simple and healthy and delicious.
Oh, it's delicious. It tastes... Yeah. It when you say cedar, I don't think of... But it has this sort of piney, almost junipery sort of flavor, very light.
Yeah, it's very light and sweet. It tastes like camping.
Yeah, it totally tastes like camping. Oh my God, that's beautiful. And you have some a few other things. You have these nuts.
Yep, we have some of the pinon pine nuts that come from the Southwest. And those are, you know, a little bit of a tougher shell, but they're really sweet on the inside. They're almost honey sweet.
Yeah, crazy. It's almost like it's candied inside the shell already.
Yeah.
And they're like super sort of creamy.
Yep. And it's a big deal to go out harvesting those in that part of the States.
Amazing. And you have some of these wild herbs as well.
Yep. There's some Labrador, which is also known as swamp tea, which grows heavily all throughout here. And there's some dried apple blossom, which is just sweet and tangy. And there's some Ocotillo blossom from the Southwest. Again, that's kind of tangy. And yeah, we just kind of look at a lot of these wild herbs and we try to grab them while they're in season. It's fun that we get to trade some of these flavors with other people around different parts of the country too. So we have some diversity to play with.
Yeah, for sure. And so let me ask you I think most people don't know much about what you might call Native American food to begin with. But if you do bring it up, if there is an item that people think of, it's usually fry bread.
Right.
But you don't make fry bread.
Nope, we didn't see any point in it. I mean, I grew up with fry bread and it tastes great, but it kind of is everything that, you know, isn't Native American food in the sense of really digging backwards. You know, so since we removed flour, you know, that's pretty much the bulk of it. And we look at the origins of fry bread and it really, you know, is coming from, it's coming from the army, basically. It's, you know, showing people, you know, how to make a very simple staple out of flour and lard and salt and sugar, you know, I deep fry it in a pan. And it was widely used, but there's no reason that fry bread should be like the go-to piece for every single indigenous community across North America, because there's just so much awesome diversity and there's so much more to learn. And, you know, even though fry bread tastes good and it's been integrated into the cultures, there's just so much more knowledge out there.
Yeah. And you brought this other thing that I'd love to try now. This is, can you describe this little bite I'm about to try?
Yep. So that's just amaranth cooked down and dried out into a cracker. So it's just light and sweet and crisp. And there is some cedar braised rabbit. And then we caramelized it with a little bit of maple sugar. And it's got a little piece of nasturtium on top and a little bit of the wojapi, which is just a mixed berry sauce. So just a simple bite, but a bunch of flavor.
Yeah, let me try this. Wow, that's awesome. I love how crunchy that amaranth gets. You said you just cooked it down and then...
Yeah, just almost like a polenta, you know, just cook it in just very simple, some water and just a tiny touch of maple and just cooked it till it's thick. And then we just formed it, ran it through a dehydrator, and the next day it's perfect little crackers.
Yeah, it's so crunchy and you get that little bit of that earthiness from the amaranth, I'm sure from the rabbit as well, and all that maple sugar is... very mild, but it tastes like the woods. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really tastes like the woods. And there's that little bit of nasturtium gives it a pepperiness, even though you're not using black pepper that was brought here by the Europeans. So what an amazing treat to get to taste that, but also to think about how this is telling a different story of Native American food. This is not the Indian taco. This isn't fry bread. This is going back to these flavors that existed before Europeans came to this country and doing something new with them. This is amazing. Thank you, Chef.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Sean Sherman is the author of The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. You can find his recipe for maple juniper roast pheasant and for that delicious cedar tea we were drinking on our website, splendidtable.org. You know, when Sean and I were chatting, he talked a little bit about fry bread and why he doesn't make it. But in his book, he alludes to the controversy around fry bread in Native communities. So it starts with its history, right? Sean writes that when the federal government forced Natives off the lands they knew and put them onto reservations, people lost control of their food. They put them in totally different environments, so they no longer knew what grows well or where to hunt or fish or forage, so they started to rely on commodity foods like white flour and powdered milk and lard, and fry bread is the result of that pantry. Native cooks figured they could mix up a dough, boil it in oil, and you have a crispy, chewy thing that keeps you full, and so it became a staple. Now, Sean and many others see it as a terrible staple. It's got tons of fat and calories and almost no other nutrients, and they see that diabetes and obesity are widespread in their communities. There's a Native musician named Keith Sekula who sings, "Fry breads killed more Indians than the federal government." But at the same time, I remember years ago, watching the movie Smoke Signals by the writer Sherman Alexie, and one of the main characters wears a shirt that says Fry Bread Power. And Alexie calls fry bread the story of our survival, and so it's also a symbol of ingenuity and perseverance. And all I could think about after talking to Sean was that cultures by nature love their foods. But how strange and hard it must be if the staple food of your culture leaves you feeling so conflicted. Coming up, the masterful Dory Greenspan on butter, and America's Test Kitchen defends pumpkin spice. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. Dori Greenspan is a part-time Parisian and a full-time baking guru, so she knows a few things about butter. It's an essential ingredient in the 12 cookbooks she's written, but Lucky Number 13 is all about butter. It's a fabulous little book with recipes and tips and techniques that take butter to a new level. Splendid Table contributor Shauna Seaver caught up with Dori from New York City.
Hi, Dori. Thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm so happy to be here with you.
Now, you have to be the perfect person to ask this question of. Tell us how your love affair with butter first began.
Oh, it was many years ago. You know, James Beard used to talk about how as a baby, he was a fat baby. And I don't know that he was talking about his size. He was talking about his love of fat. I grew up with butter. I didn't grow up in a house where anybody cooked or baked, but boy, they were good at spreading butter on bread. And I love butter. I love it for its flavor. I love it for the way it produces texture in both sweet and savory things. I love it for its flavor.
Well, that's such an interesting point that you bring up. And you talk about this in the book, that butter serves so many functions in recipes. And you've showcased that in many thoughtful ways throughout the book. Can you tell us about some of those functions?
It was so much fun to think about butter and all the things that it does for us in the kitchen, and to find recipes that would, in fact, showcase those qualities. And so I thought about when butter changes the texture of something or adds to the texture. I thought about it in terms of when you really taste butter. I mean, butter can be a background flavor in so many things. Butter changes the color of things. If you brown butter, you get the flavor of butter, and then you get the taste of toasted hazelnuts as well. So working on this really gave me the chance to think about how butter expresses itself in so many different ways in the kitchen.
And you talk about some of the recipes where butter actually serves as a glue of sorts to hold the dish together.
It's so funny. I don't know why the thought of butter as glue I find very amusing, but in fact, that's exactly what it does. In actually one of my favorite dishes, the miso butter double salmon rillette. So rillette was traditionally in French cooking, pork that had been cooked, slow, hours in its own fat until it became spreadable. And I now make many different kinds of salmon rillette. And so this one uses both smoked salmon and fresh salmon. And the glue is butter and miso, or miso butter. And it's such a lovely combination. So you get that salty kind of, well, it is umami flavor from the miso, and the lovely texture of the butter, that silken, velvety texture that you get, and then that great flavor of smoked salmon and plain salmon. It's a great dish, and it comes together. This is my party trick, because it takes about 10 or 15 minutes to put it together. It's so much better if you make it ahead, and it's so delicious. And it really sounds better when you call it double salmon rillette than when you call it salmon held together with butter glue.
I might eat it either way. But in this case, I mean, that's a recipe where butter really is the star. But you had me thinking about butter in different ways, as in how a grilled cheese sandwich is really as much about the butter as it is about the cheese.
It really is, because grilled cheese sandwich, there's nothing to it, right? It's butter. It's cheese. You can put tomato in there. You can put bacon in there if you want. But it's essentially two ingredients. And yet, done right, you can get great textural contrasts. And, of course, you get great flavor. And you get goo. And we love goo. We love that gooey stretchiness that you get from the cheese. But with a good grilled cheese sandwich, what you want is clarified butter. So it's butter that you'll be able to cook it at a higher temperature and not have it brown or burn. So you spread the outside of the sandwich with clarified butter, and then when you cook it and you're pressing it down, you get the best, crackliest crust on the bread. So you get that crackle of the bread, then the softness of the bread and the gooiness of the cheese, and then it repeats itself. And so the butter really is the ingredient that makes the sandwich great.
You have me thinking about using different types of butter as a way to really change up recipes, that things that we make all the time with butter. So can you tell us about a few of the main types that are out there now and how we can best use them?
Sure. So I, when I'm testing recipes for publication, always use butter from the supermarket. Use Cabot's or I use Land O'Lakes because I want to use a butter that's at the level that all of my bakers will be able to find. But it's awfully fun to play around with some of the European butters. By law, European butter has a higher butterfat content than American butter. Our minimum butterfat content is 80%, and in Europe it's 82%. When we have salted butter, the butterfat content is lower. And so if you get a European butter, taste it, and taste it against the regular butter that you've been using or that you might have, and you'll taste more butter, but you'll also feel it. You can feel the difference in the butter fat. Mm-hmm. And if you get a cultured butter, you'll feel the difference in the butter fat, and you'll taste a kind of tang. And that's from, it's got more acidity than regular, you know, I'm using air quotes, regular butter, because it's been cultured, because it's been fermented. And it's fun to play around with these different butters. So I like to use a European butter or a cultured butter when I'm baking. I think then it really makes a difference. Mm-hmm. If you're making a compound butter, a flavored butter, if you're baking something, then it's wonderful to have that extra bit of butter fat and that extra flavor.
That sounds wonderful. Well, Dori, thank you so much. You're always a delight and an absolute treasure. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Shauna, it was great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Dori Greenspan's latest book is called Butter. Shauna Seaver is the author of Real Sweet. And Dori left us her recipes for miso butter double salmon rillettes, as well as those pressed and griddled cheese sandwiches you talked about. Find them both at splendidtable.org. So as we speak, it is pumpkin spice latte season, the most love it or hate it time of year. Well, our friends at America's Test Kitchen want us all to love it. Well, pumpkin spice anyway, not necessarily the whole latte part. And so Tucker Shaw is here to convince our producer, Sally Swift, that pumpkin spice can be redeemed.
Hey, Tucker. Great to have you back.
Hey, Sally. How are you doing?
All is well. So I was with my teenage daughter in a Starbucks the other day. That, you know, you can't walk in that place without being totally hit over the head with pumpkin spice smell. And she turned to me and I said, Have you ever had a pumpkin spice latte? And she said, Mom, their pumpkin spice is black gel, which is pretty, it's a pretty scary thought. And you know, it is, it's kind of been ruined, I think. And you have taken it on.
Go ahead and get your licks in because, you know, pumpkin spice deserves better than what it's gotten. And listen, if you've lost the teenagers, it's already past its prime.
I know, you're in big trouble. That's exactly right.
But here's the thing. Pumpkin spice is really, really a simple blend of spices, and you probably have them all in your kitchen right now. They're favorites. I'm talking about ground cinnamon, ground ginger, ground nutmeg, and ground allspice. Those are the scents and flavors of the holidays. Who doesn't want to have that?
Right, and not a pumpkin to be seen.
Usually in most of the products where you find it, no, there's no pumpkin at all. And, you know, it has shown up in some really silly places. Frozen waffles, sandwich cookies, you know, really, really bizarre places. We decided to bring it back into a very simple recipe for pumpkin spice muffins.
Okay, I want to talk about that recipe, but I want to talk about the spices too. So did you do your own blend or did you buy premixed pumpkin pie spice?
We did both, and we sampled two or three versions that we found at the grocery store, and we liked them quite well. You can easily make your own, though, by combining those four spices, cinnamon, ginger, nutmeg, and allspice. And if you do buy a version that's sold at the grocery store, just take a glance at the label and make sure that it doesn't have any kind of weird stuff in it.
Okay, that makes sense. And then tell us about this recipe that in which you're going to redeem pumpkin pie spice for everyone.
Well, the most important thing that we did here, I think, is we brought pumpkin back because these spices belong with pumpkin. So we created a very simple recipe for muffins. This recipe will be familiar to anybody who's made a muffin of almost any variety before. You essentially whisk together some dry ingredients of flour, sugar, spices, and some baking powder. And then in a separate bowl, you whisk together some canned pumpkin, eggs, melted butter, and milk. And then you combine them together, scoop them out into your muffin tin, and cover them with a very simple streusel topping and bake away.
Sounds perfect and simple. And canned pumpkin over fresh?
Canned pumpkin over fresh. You can certainly roast your own pumpkin and go that route, but the canned pumpkin is much, much easier. And the great thing about pumpkin in a muffin recipe or a quick bread recipe is that it contributes body and moisture and sort of a richness. So that means you don't need to use quite as much, you know, butter. You don't need to use oil. You don't end up with greasy muffins. You just end up with really, really flavorful muffins that have a lovely, tender, crumbly texture.
And great. So we bake them up and our kitchen's going to smell like Starbucks.
It's going to be amazing. You're going to love it. And so much better than any coffee shop you can imagine.
And while I have you here,
yeah.
So we got a call from a listener a couple of weeks ago that had us all stumped. He called and he has a 100-pound pumpkin he's wondering what he can do with. And we have no idea. What do you say, Tucker Shaw?
Holy great pumpkin. That sounds huge.
100 pounds.
Yeah. Geez. I think that would be a tough thing to tackle in the kitchen. So if I were you, I would just carve out the biggest jack-o'-lantern on the block, take lots of pictures of it, and see if you can win a contest in your town.
Stick to the sculpture.
Yeah, why not?
All right. Hey, thanks, Tucker.
Thank you, Sally.
Tucker Shaw is editor-in-chief of Cook's Country Magazine. You can find the recipe for pumpkin spice muffins at splendidtable.org. All right, so it is time for us to talk. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or pick up that phone, 1-800-537-5252. We want to know what you're cooking, what you're thinking about. Let's get going. We have Sarah on the line from Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Sarah, how are you?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I have recently discovered an abundance of wild sumac growing in my neighborhood and around my house. And,
oh, cool.
Yeah, as a kid, we used to make sumac lemonade. So we would basically like cold steep the sumac in our fridge for about 24 hours and it would kind of make this pink lemonade drink. I mean, I didn't actually put lemons in it. It just sort of tasted like lemonade. So we didn't really even have to add any sugar or anything. It just kind of makes this tangy lemonade flavored drink. And that was a lot of fun. But I know that sumac is used in Middle Eastern kind of seasonings, and I wasn't really sure how to even prepare it for that. So,
yeah, yeah. So I first have to say, wild sumac. I actually don't know if if you've used it and it's safe, then that's awesome. I just want to warn other listeners, like if you find something like that, you probably want to check to make sure it's like the right kind of sumac that's edible.
Yeah.
but in general, sumac, it's not something that I have a ton of experience with, but you are totally right. It is very common in lots of Middle Eastern cooking. There's a spice mix called za'atar that's this really beautiful mix. It's like it's tangy, it's savory, it's got sesame seeds and different herbs. And but the word za'atar, I believe, refers to the sumac in it. So it gets a lemony, tangy flavor from this little berry that dries up and you can pulverize.
Yes.
And I think, so za'atar is a really wonderful condiment, or you can use it as a flavoring, you can use it as a rub, or, you know, that kind of thing. You can find recipes for it online for sure. It's typically like different dried herbs, a fair amount of that sumac and sesame seeds, and often with salt already mixed in too, so it's this really full-flavored thing. I would also say, if you're just like playing and experimenting, I think what's really exciting about sumac is that it gives you a flavor very much like lemon, but without having to add any liquid or any moisture to a dish or to an item. And so I think about something like, I'm a mayonnaise freak. I love mayonnaise. You're from Kentucky, so maybe you feel the same way.
Yes, I am. mayonnaise and everything. Cake.
Yeah, and it is, you know, it is one of the great gifts of the universe. But I think one thing that happens with mayonnaise, like the science of it is, you know, it loosens up so fast once you start adding any kind of water to it. You know, it just really thins out super fast when you have a nice thick mayonnaise and you like to keep it nice and thick. So I think adding sumac to a mayonnaise can give you a really cool, super lemony, bright mayonnaise that is still has that beautiful, thick texture. Because you're not adding any liquid to really thin it out. So I think that's a really cool way of thinking about it. I love the idea of sprinkling sumac onto something like an ice cream where, you know, you have that cold, rich ice cream and then you can get this really bright pop of that lemon flavor. But again, you're not adding liquid to it. It doesn't take away from that texture.
That sounds like something yogurt. That might need pistachios too.
Oh, yeah. You're talking. Now you're talking. That sounds awesome. I'm also a pistachio freak, so like mayonnaise and pistachios are like two of my great loves. If someone can make a mayonnaise out of pistachio, I would like worship at their altar. But something like sprinkle it, you know, as a seasoning blend with an unusual places where you can get a great pop of lemon. And I want to say, you know, not just lemon flavor, because like lemon flavor, you know, we talk about lemon flavor, but it comes in, you know, lemon juice and there's lemon zest, you know, and they're obviously related, but they are different effects. But if you want to add like the tart flavor of lemon to something without having to add any kind of moisture, sumac is a great way to do that.
Awesome.
Cool.
So
well,
fun. Thank you so much.
I'm so glad you found that treasure trove of sumac and enjoy that.
Yeah, I have sumac coming out of my ears, so.
Cool. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. And we'll be back with more of your questions and a deep dive into the world of mushrooms. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam. We are talking to you. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or just call us 1-800-537-5252. We want to know what you're cooking, what you're thinking about. I'd love this part. All right, we have Devin from Asheville, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Devin, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. What would you like to talk about?
I was given or allowed to pick 350 pounds of apples off a friend's tree, and I'm out of ideas. I have done applesauce, apple butter, jelly, vinegar, pie filling, and two different kinds of chutney, and dried about 5 gallons of apples. So... I don't have freezer space, and we don't drink much alcohol. So other than that, I'm looking for ways to preserve these.
Oh, you did say 350 pounds of apples, didn't you?
Yeah, 2 trees full of apples.
Oh, wow. That is, well, I can certainly say I've never been asked that before. congratulations to you on having... 2 fully grown human body weights in apples.
Thank you.
I think you've named every possible way I could think of preserving them. You said butter, you said sauce, you said dried. You're in Asheville. Did you dry them in sort of the traditional way where you slice them and then put them like on a screen?
It's a little humid here for that, and we have a lot of hungry birds on our property, so I just have a dehydrator.
Yeah. Okay. A friend, actually an author of mine, Ronnie Lundy, wrote this beautiful book called Vittles. It's all about food traditions of Appalachia, and there's a chapter in it where she talks about slicing apples and literally taking like a porch screen door, 2 of them, taking them off the hinges, and... setting the apple slices on those and letting them dry in the sun. It comes out to this beautiful, not quite a leather, but this beautiful dried apple that you then can stew and make like a really intense pie filling, which I thought was such a cool tradition.
I heard about apple schnitz or schnitz pie, which is a dried apple pie also, which is probably something similar.
Oh, interesting. So I gotta say, you stumped the cook for sure. I mean, I think here's a truckload of something.
I'm down to about 40 pounds of apples. So I've done a number on it. I've got a lifetime supply of applesauce at this point. I could do more of what I've already done.
You have already handled 310 pounds of apples. The other 40 should not be. You'll figure it out. But I think let's think about ways you can 40 pounds is still a lot of apples, but I think you can start like eating your way through them now, you know. Let's think of some cool things to do. I mean, I think simply, let's think of dishes you can eat where apples are the star, or at least as much a main part of the dish than anything else. I mean, I think when you have nice apples, often like they're so nice, but as an accent, you know, a few slices or a few dice into a salad that give that pop of tartness or a little bit of sweetness, like that's a lovely thing. But like, you know, one apple is going to take you to like a whole salad bowl, and like you don't need that, you need more. So I'm thinking, you know, everyone loves the combination of apples and pork, maybe everyone except for me, only because I feel like usually it comes out a little bit too sweet for me, too much on the fruit side. But I think about for the pork, if I do something more savory, more seasoned, something like a sausage, something like a really nice sausage that's well seasoned, that has a lot of oomph, then you can roast some apples alongside it. Mm-hmm. Maybe hit the apples also with a little bit of salt to sort of mitigate their sweetness as well. Throw in some sage or some other herbs. The sausages might have a nice amount of fat, but you can always add a little bit of butter to the apples as well. And maybe a little bit of, sliced onion or something like that to give it more of a savory character. So maybe that doesn't help you that much. But in general, I think if you're trying to work your way through apples, like you can use them almost as like the sort of vegetable or a starch component to a dish if you're roasting a nice, well-seasoned sausage.
I've been a vegetarian for 25 years, but I can make it for company. Okay.
Man, I didn't know the rules. I didn't have the rules in front of me. Here's one more.
I did grow a bunch of butternut squash, and I thought about doing like a butternut carrot apple soup of some kind.
Yeah, I think absolutely. A butternut squash, carrot, and apple soup sounds terrific, because what you have there is three different kinds of sweetness, and you'll have acidity from the apple. And I think those things will blend together beautifully. And then what you'll probably want to do is just make sure you're seasoning it with enough salt. And if you want to add other aromatics, obviously like onion and shallot and garlic are, you know, classic and everyone loves them, you can do that as well to get a nice rounded flavor. And I would just cook those in stock, or because you have so much of this nice, beautiful vegetable, even just water is probably going to do you well. Season it with plenty of salt when you cook it before you puree it. And I would also say, you know, to think about seasoning it with something like a soy sauce, or maybe with a little bit of miso paste. And kind of what I'm getting at is something that has not just salt, but a nice deep fermented flavor, because you have all that sweetness in the squash and the carrot and the apple. So something that gives it a little bit of a base note, you know what I mean? Like a foundation. So something that has a depth could do well for you there. Or even cheese, you know, when you're serving it, if you're not using that in the cooking, when you're serving it, serve it with a lot of nice cheese. You know, a grated Parmesan would be great, of course. But if you do like a nice finely grated, like aged cheddar, I could see that being really beautiful with it. I would also think of serving it like with a nice garnish of nuts or pumpkin seeds, or, you know, some nice fall crunchy thing.
Sounds great. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, I wish you luck in handling your last 40 pounds of apples, but I have no doubt you'll get there.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call.
All right. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
I would love to see what 350 pounds of apples looks like. Is it like a kiddie pool? Is that, will that get you 350 pounds if you fill a whole kiddie pool of apples? Always feel free to call us at 1-800-537-5252 or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So how many times have you heard a mushroom described as meaty? I mean, I never really bought the idea that a portobello was really like a burger, but, you know, I kind of get it, right? They have a little chew, they have a little juiciness, they have umami. But our next guest wants us to think beyond the meatiness of mushrooms. Like, how about mushrooms that are naturally fruity, like apricots? Or some that taste a little bit like coconut? Or some that give off the scent of cinnamon when you sear them? Liz O'Keefe is a British chef who wrote about 40 different kinds of mushrooms and how to cook them in The Mushroom Cookbook. She talked with our contributor, David Leet, about the wide world of mushrooms.
Liz, I'm delighted that you could join us all the way across the pond over there in London. So welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Liz, talk a bit about the flavor profiles of the different mushrooms. I think when people talk of mushrooms, they say that wonderful earthy flavor, but
yeah,
it's more complicated than that, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, some families are quite similar, but really no two mushrooms are the same. Like if you think about the Caesar mushroom, which is actually my favorite mushroom, it's like an egg-shaped, bright orange, velvety, gilled beauty of a mushroom, which is really delicate, great raw, or just lightly sautéed. And it's really sweet. It kind of, some people think it tastes a bit of apricot. So you would never put that with, say, a game like stew that you might put porcini, a more like sturdy, robust, umami tasting mushroom. So you treat them quite differently, and it really is experiencing getting out there and cooking with those mushrooms, going to your farmer's market or wherever you can buy them from, and just finding out for yourself.
What are some of the other base notes or base flavors to mushrooms? I think you even talked a bit about how some of them have a bit of a citrus flavor.
Yeah, they're really, well, they're fruiting bodies and their taste is influenced by where they're growing. A lot of, some mushrooms are actually decomposers, so they live off tree bark or decomposing leaves. So it really does depend on the tree or the vegetation around, like some are oaky. Some, especially like button mushrooms, can almost taste like coconutty when they're raw. There's a lot of kind of like maybe sesame seed or almost oily essences coming through with some of them. Yeah, it really can depend, but it's from fruity to really like forest, robust flavors. It's a bit like wine, maybe.
That's a wonderful comparison. Now, can you give us a mushroom hit list of mushrooms that would be really good for us to add to the repertoire we already are cooking with?
Yeah, well, if you're quite new to mushrooms, as in like wild mushrooms that you might find, so the seasonal ones, right now, with autumn, porcini would be the one to go with. Some people call them seps. They're really meaty. Like, I think they actually add more than meat can to like a good roast or a gravy. They're really rich. And I really do think they're the best mushroom. There's just so much flavor in them. Their texture's amazing. If you see them, then, you know, get a few and cook them straight away. Fresher, the better. Because obviously if you're buying from a market, they're probably about a day from being picked. So yeah, good to get those flavors fresh. Puffball is one of my favorites. A giant puffball. Yeah. They're as big as your head. And you can slice them and fry them with bacon, or you can even like batter them, put tempura batter, and you serve them with like soy sauce or chili. They're very robust. They're full of vitamins and a good source of protein. So yeah, anything that looks really weird like that, I would definitely go for. And then just, quickly, the lobster mushroom, I believe, grows quite regularly in the US. So
yeah,
if you
stunners.
See those about this time of year, then absolutely go for it. You treat it just like lobster in a way. It smells a bit like lobster. It looks like lobster. Mm-hmm. The colour, bright orange colour, is just immense. And it's a real treat, just kind of grilled with a bit of oil on toast, just with a little bit of seasoning, maybe a bit of lemon zest.
And I think that there's a lot of confusion when it comes to cleaning mushrooms. You hear wash, rinse, wipe, repeat. Any guidelines we can keep in mind when it comes to preparing and washing mushrooms, cleaning mushrooms?
Yeah. Well, the thing is with mushrooms, again, it's kind of similar to the taste profile and how you cook them. They're all quite different. But for cleaning mushrooms, it kind of falls quite neatly into two groups. So you have your more delicate mushrooms and your sturdier mushrooms. So with the delicate ones, they're kind of thin and spindly, usually wild or cultivated, and they can take a quick rinse in a water bath, but very, very quickly, just to get the dirt and the grit off. I mean, with cultivated mushrooms, there's hardly any dirt anyway, and then dry them. Because they're really about the looks and the texture rather than any bold flavour. So you can kind of get away with that. But with the more sturdy mushrooms, they really, like porcini, as I mentioned, Pied de Mouton, they really need to just have a wipe with a wet cloth or kitchen roll, because as soon as they go into water, they just soak it all up, and then that's all you're going to taste, the flavourless water, and they might go a bit mushy as well. So that's probably where the bad experiences come from with mushrooms, if anyone has any.
So after the cleaning of the mushrooms, it's the cooking of the mushrooms. Any tips on how to do that?
Well, it kind of quite neatly falls again into the delicate and the sturdy. So usually I would use the sturdy first because they've got the flavour, and would need a bit more cooking. And some mushrooms, they can't be eaten raw, so you have to make sure they're cooked properly. So they were going in the beginning of a dish. So say when you're going to, like, after you've sautéed onions, put in the sturdy mushrooms, say if you were making a risotto. And then when it comes to the more delicate mushrooms, they really are about that final flourish of colour and texture. So you want to keep them firm and together. So you would put them in as late as possible into the dish. So maybe, you know, that last couple of minutes where you stir in something else like the fresh herbs or a little bit more seasoning. And also, you know, research it, but I won't cut out eating mushrooms raw. They can be really delicious raw.
Liz, it was great talking to you, and thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Liz O'Keefe is the co-author of The Mushroom Cookbook with Michael Hyams, and she left us with two terrific recipes, mushroom and oyster pies and kale and shiitake soup. You can find them as ever on splendidtable.org. David Leitt's latest book is Notes on a Banana, a memoir of food, love, and manic depression. And that's our show for the week. Thank you, as always, for listening. Please join us again next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this little bit from a writer I think is a national treasure, R. Eric Thomas. He wrote, "When's the last time I ate actual pumpkin? I wouldn't even know how. The inside of every pumpkin looks like somebody already got there first and looted all the good stuff." You can find plenty more episodes like the one you just heard by browsing our podcast archive. So be sure to subscribe if you don't already, and leave us a review, but, you know, please be gentle. And don't miss out on our website. You can register for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, browse the recipe archive, and watch our weekly videos. This week, it's Lynn's version of a classic. She calls it 21st Century Mac and Cheese, and it is amazing. Find it all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell, with help from Courtney McEwen. Jennifer Lubke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb. And this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.